On the program today, we're talking clean energy, college admissions, and why companies will not stop texting us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Rima Khais in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, July 31st. Good to have you with us. It has been one very hot summer. In many parts of the country, the extreme heat has not just been unbearable, but relentless. With these higher temperatures also comes demand for electricity. Got to keep those AC units, fans, dehumidifiers running throughout the day. But all of that is putting a strain on the power plants and the electric grid, which further heats up the planet. All of this to set up our first story today. Nuclear power is totally free of carbon emissions. And over in Georgia, a new reactor at a nuclear power plant came online today. It's the first new one to be built from scratch in the U.S. in decades. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on what this project can tell us about America's energy future.
The nuclear reactor at Plant Vogtle in Georgia is the first of two new reactors at the plant, ultimately capable of powering 500,000 homes in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. But the project is 7 years behind and more than double the projected cost, to the tune of almost $35 billion.
The challenge is this is really a first-of-a-kind project. And I know that sounds weird because the U.S. does have so much nuclear. It's 20% of our electricity.
Jessica Lovering is the executive director of Good Energy Collective, which advocates for nuclear energy.
But the U.S. industry really kind of closed down or was in a cold shutdown for 30 years. We weren't building new projects.
Partly because of incidents like the Fukushima disaster in Japan, which scared people, but also because building these plants is really expensive. So even when fossil fuel prices went up, nuclear often wasn't an attractive option, says Isabella Alcaniz, who teaches government and politics at the University of Maryland.
Now, climate change, global warming seem to offer another window of opportunity. But again, the big issues of safety and cost keep being an obstacle.
And who bears those costs will be the big issue moving forward, says Tim Eccles of Georgia's Public Service Commission. Plant Vogtle has been a passion project of his, and Eccles says he's glad it's up and running, but
I don't know that I would enter into doing this again without a financial backstop from the federal government that says these reactors will not cost you any more than X, no matter what.
Eccles says plant owners and equipment manufacturers had to eat some of the cost overruns, but utility customers will also see their electricity bills go up about $5 a month as soon as this week. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As we've talked about on this show, it is not a great time to be in the market for a house. We've seen prices drop a bit from their peak last year, but they're still high, and so are mortgage rates. Now, if you're a homeowner, it is a very different picture. A new report from the real estate data firm Adam shows the rate of mortgage borrowers considered equity rich, meaning their loan balance was up to half of their home's value, increased to 49% in the second quarter. That is a four-year high. But as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports, that doesn't mean it's necessarily the best time to tap into that equity.
If you're lucky enough to own your own home, there's a good chance that home's value has risen in the last few years, meaning your equity, the difference between your home's value and what you owe on your mortgage, has risen too. And in the event of something like a death, divorce, or job loss, homeowners could access that wealth through a home equity loan, says Selma Hepp, chief economist at CoreLogic.
Just knowing that you have that equity and if, you know, push comes to shove, you can tap into it. It's a very positive place to be for homeowners.
But with high interest rates right now, taking out a loan or refinancing your mortgage might not make much sense, especially if you locked in a mortgage when rates were really low a couple years ago, says Susan Wachter, a professor of real estate at the Wharton School of Business.
Why would you refinance if you've got a mortgage of 3% at a mortgage rate of 7%? So this equity remains untapped.
Higher rates also mean homeowners aren't using their equity to buy new houses either, says Guy Sakala, executive chair of Inside Mortgage Finance.
Many people are trapped in their home and their home equity is trapped in their home with them.
One thing that could change that, Sakala says, is if the Federal Reserve stops raising interest rates, leading mortgage rates to fall.
And that certainly will be welcome news and probably free up a lot of home buyers to buy houses and for homeowners to sell their houses.
But exactly when the Fed might start to reverse course on interest rates is anyone's guess. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, it's up just a smidge. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision to end race-based affirmative action, we are now seeing more schools pulling back on giving preference to applicants who are related to alumni. Occidental College, a private liberal arts school in Los Angeles, is among the latest to end legacy admissions. But the benefits of being a legacy student often don't end at the admissions office. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes explains.
About six decades ago, President Lyndon Johnson called education the most important door that will ever open. Legacy applicants, then and now, get more help opening those doors. Jennifer Jesse's an independent college admissions consultant in Virginia.
It's kind of like the difference between walking into a party and not knowing anybody and walking into a party and you know everybody there.
Legacy applicants know people who've gotten into this party before and can make calls on their behalf.
You're probably going to get a private tour. You're not going to have to go on the normal tour. You're going to have more one-on-one.
That kind of informal access can give applicants a better sense of how the admissions process works, which can boost their chances of getting in, says Mamie Void, who leads the Institute for Higher Education Policy. She also points out there are big financial benefits to being a legacy, such as scholarships specifically aimed at them.
And we've even seen some instances where students who are out of state can qualify for in-state tuition at a public institution if their parents are members of the alumni association.
Which can make the difference between being able to attend or not. And sometimes the benefits continue once a student has enrolled.
Where they have access to special welcome receptions or even early move-in opportunities so that they can move into the dorms before other students.
Voigt says these kinds of things can help students adjust to college, which also means they'll be better equipped to graduate. So legacy students are not only more likely to get into the party, they're more likely to avoid a hangover once the party ends. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We all know that marriage is a commitment to have and to hold and all of that, but it's also a financial commitment. Usually means intertwining your financial life with another person's, which can inevitably lead to some big complications, ones that might even outlast the marriage. I got to thinking about this after I got an email from a listener of the Marketplace podcast that I host, This is Uncomfortable. She wrote, quote, "My second marriage was the biggest financial mistake I ever made." We're going to call her Sally. It's not her real name. She wants to stay private because of family concerns. Sally is 79 years old, and she's from New York. On a warm spring day, I met up with her at her home. Can I take my shoes off?
You do whatever you feel comfortable with. I just physically, for some reason or other, I never like to wear shoes.
As we sat down in her living room, she told me she was raised mostly by her mom, who gave her a lot of relationship advice.
My mother used to say to me, have your own bank account. And I thought, oh, what does she know? Like, you know, that's so unromantic.
Decades later, she'd realized that her mom was right. Sally's first marriage ended tragically after her husband died in a car accident. She was a young widow with a toddler. Then a couple of years later, she met a guy who we'll call Todd. They got married, and in their relationship, Sally was the breadwinner. She had a government job making decent money, while Todd focused on his education. But when he eventually dropped out of school, Sally started to get anxious.
I had some money in a checking account, and I remember thinking a couple of times, thinking, well, at least I have that little cushion there, so if anything goes wrong.
She had $5,000 in savings. Today, that would be over $35,000. And then one day, it was just gone. Todd took it.
I said, what happened here? And he said, well, I needed the money. I don't even think he apologized for it.
He told her, don't worry, I've got a plan. We're going to flip properties and become millionaires. Todd had a background in construction.
He was very good at his work. He knew how to take care of this.
And so it sounds like at first it was successful.
It was successful.
But then Sally, since she was the one with the good credit, she started co-signing loans to help them buy more properties.
And that's when all the problems began.
They'd get paid, her husband would cash the check, and then...
Where was the money going? I just did not know then. If I didn't know then, I don't know for sure now.
And so when you'd go into the bank...
There was nothing accumulating.
As Todd spent their money on who knows what, their financial life started to go downhill. They began borrowing money from private lenders.
We used our house as collateral. So he comes upstairs one day and he says, we have to be out of this house in 2 weeks. And I said, oh my God.
Her memories of this era are defined by financial insecurity. Bounced checks, overdue bills, debt collectors. And then the final straw. She learned that for weeks, Todd had been lying to her about going into work.
And I say, what's going on? He was getting up, getting dressed, and going out every morning as if he was going to work. So,
oh my God, that's madness.
I said, this is it. I am out of this.
Sally divorced him. But since she'd co-signed the loans, she was still responsible for them. It took years for her to financially recover. Even though it's been decades since all of this went down, it's had a profound impact on her. She remembers her wages getting garnished, how she'd sneak into the back door of her home to avoid process servers.
If I get somebody ringing my doorbell and I don't expect it, I get really nervous. I've always been someone who's going to live within my means. But this intensified it, that I have to have every bill paid in full every month. I can't carry a balance.
After her divorce, Sally never pursued another serious relationship. Hearing her story, I thought about how financial anxieties get passed down through generations. Like, Sally's mom taught her to never depend on anyone else. And that sense of anxiety compounded when, after trusting the wrong person, Sally almost lost everything. And now she's racked with anxiety for her two granddaughters. She'll often grab them by the arm and tell them, listen, you have to save money. And most importantly,
no woman can depend on a man. You have to be able to take care of yourself. That's it. And I have said that in so many words, so many times.
How do they usually respond?
Yes, Grandma.
Sally tells me her granddaughters sound a lot like she did when her mom, once upon a time, gave her similar advice. If you want more personal stories about money, you can check out the Marketplace show that I host, This is Uncomfortable, wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up,
it is a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole.
Love a good old game of whack-a-mole. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones rose 100 points, about 0.3%, to close at 35,559. The NASDAQ added 29 points, 0.2%, to land at 14,346. And the S&P 500 found 6 points, 0.1%, to close at 4588. For the month of July, the Dow advanced 3.3%, the NASDAQ gained 3.8%, and the S&P 500 grew 3%. Kimberly Adams told us about that new nuclear plant in Georgia. Today, Georgia Power shaved off 0.5%. Its parent firm, Southern Company, was little changed. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So we started off the show talking about nuclear power plants as a way to help with climate change. Wind energy is another part of the effort. Over in Wyoming, federal and local officials recently broke ground on a new power line project. It'll transfer wind power to the southwest part of the country. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, this project is a pretty big deal for a state that produces a lot of fossil fuel.
1, 2, 3.
In the sagebrush desert of Carbon County, Wyoming, officials break ground with shovels on the Transwest Express transmission project. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland speaks to a crowd about the 730-mile power line as wind rips through flags behind her.
We know that clean energy transmission lines on public lands will help communities across the country to be part of the climate solution while creating good-paying jobs.
In this same area, a wind farm is under construction. The power line will eventually transmit that electricity to about 1 million homes located in places like L.A., Las Vegas, and Phoenix. Normally, Wyoming is at odds with the Biden administration's push to move away from fossil fuels. The state has sued the federal government over the pace of leasing to allow drilling for oil and natural gas on public lands. But Wyoming's Republican Governor Mark Gordon came to the groundbreaking.
Because there's an urgency. As we see climate change, we know that we don't have time to waste. We have to move with diligence forward to make sure that we address the issue of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
It is a stark difference from Carbon County's energy history, which is all about oil, natural gas, and coal. U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says that needs to change.
We want people to say yes. Yes to clean energy in the same way people have said yes to fossil energy.
And some people are saying yes, like Terry Wycombe. He's the mayor of Rawlins, the county seat. Wycombe wears a windmill pin on his shirt. He says the town has been in a bust as people lost jobs from the local coal mines closing and the oil fields slowing.
It is a lucky break for us to get this incredible thing in our midst. Some people don't like it. Some people don't like ice cream. I don't know what to tell you.
Wycombe says people don't like it because
they feel like it's replacing. Well, the coal's gone, and they've been closed. We need it all. You know, we need all the energy sources we can. It's not a competition.
The Transwest project will bring about 1,000 construction jobs over the next decade to build the line. And by then, it'll be delivering power to the Southwest. At a post-groundbreaking celebration at the Rawlins Train Depot, dozens of people gather, eating cake, drinking champagne, and talking energy. Damian Sesko has lived in Rawlins most of his life and runs a music academy. He's glad the project is coming to the area, but
one of the reasons we live here is the wide open spaces. You know, not everybody in the world necessarily wants to look at windmills.
Sesko is talking about that nearby wind farm that's under construction. With 600 windmills, it's slated to be the largest in the country. Even so, Sesko says the power line and wind farm are needed for the struggling economy.
Obviously, it's going to be different, but change is always different.
And this change came slowly. It took 18 years for the federal government to get all the permits and land agreements in place to build this transmission line. Officials pointed out future projects will need to be streamlined to meet the Biden administration's clean energy deadline of 2035. In Carbon County, Wyoming, I'm Caitlin Tan for Marketplace.
In my email account, I have a folder, as I'm sure many of you all do, filled with dozens and dozens and dozens of emails that I will never touch nor read. Last year, more than half of all emails sent were labeled as spam. And of that, more than a third were advertising messages. And now the marketers are coming for our phones. Emily Stewart is a senior correspondent with Vox. She wrote about how a lot of companies are hitting her up these days via text. And she joins me now to talk about it. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I love that you reported on this topic because I've noticed I've gotten a lot of text messages and have wondered if it's just me. So if you were to open your phone's text right now and scroll, what would you see? Can you give us a sense of just how inundated you've been with these marketing texts?
I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I have one from a local beauty salon that I must have signed up for. I have another beauty one for the company that makes Botox, one at the hotel I'm currently staying in. And what is this even? Oh, a drink I got at the airport the other day. It's really all, it's more than my friends.
Right? And so those texts that you're getting from the Botox beauty salon, what are they telling you? Are they offering discounts?
Different things. So the Botox one definitely is a discount. The beauty salon, honestly, is just a thing where they wanted to get my phone number for me to sign up to make an appointment. Presumably, at some point in the future, they're going to use that phone number to say, hey, don't you want to come back again? I didn't actually wind up making that appointment. So the point is, I wind up in their marketing ecosystem, and they have a new way to talk to me, to get to me, that is my phone, which I am on all the time.
Yeah. I mean, those texts do feel very similar to the kinds of texts I've been getting. Like, even last night, I bought some new plush towels that I'm very excited about. And then I immediately got a text from the company being like, hey, thanks. Stay tuned for text-only deals. And I had this moment where I was like, wait, did I even give them my number? And so based on your reporting, can you give us a sense of why these are so much more effective? You know, obviously we're checking our phones more, but I think you had some stats in there that were pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, really the long and short of it is that text message open rates are astronomically high, like a 97% read rate within 15 minutes of being delivered.
Yeah.
If you look at other estimates for emails, it's like 20%, which who knows even that.
Mm-hmm.
What companies will tell you is that it's also a way to kind of have a conversation with the recipients. You know, I talked to one person who said they were on a website thinking about buying a bag, weren't sure, left the website, and apparently her information was already on the website. Mm-hmm. She got a follow-up text saying, hey, like, do you have more questions about this? And she actually did. She wanted to know what the material was. And then she bought the bag. So companies say this is a way to kind of interact with people. It's also more expensive for them to text you than it is to email you. So maybe a plus side of this is that they probably aren't going to inundate you the same way that they will with emails because there's a cost factor to it.
Well, let's talk about the privacy concerns here. Obviously, a lot of our personal data is already all over the internet. But what does it mean that companies now have yet another piece of our information?
Part of this is just, you know, companies have so much of our information, they constantly lose it, right? We're constantly hearing about data breaches. Here is like yet another thing that's going to be in a data breach. Now, is it as serious as your social security number? No, but it's not ideal. You know, I think the good news on SMS stuff is that most of the time you can text stop. We want it to stop.
I text that several times.
Yes. Yeah. And that tends to work. It is a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole, but I think that is a little bit easier to control than your emails. It's just like, what are you even going to do at this point?
Yeah. So based on your reporting, what might we expect in the future when it comes to text messages from marketers?
Yeah, this is where I actually felt really bad in the reporting because I'm not that bothered by the marketing text messages, but I was talking to someone at a company called RoboKillers, and he said, well, you recognize like what the next like 18 months are going to be. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He said, well, it's going to be, you know, the holidays. So the brands are going to start texting us more. Also, election season is coming up. And I don't know you, but I get a ton of political texts. And I can't stop them. It's impossible. And he said, your phone's going to be a little bit rough for a while.
Well, here's to hoping that the next text we get is from a friend inviting us to a dinner party and not from a politician or a company asking if we want 15% off.
Absolutely.
Emily Stewart is a senior correspondent at Vox. Emily, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today. Henry was talking earlier about home ownership, so I thought I'd share this article I saw on CNBC. On Redfin, which is a real estate website, nearly a quarter of the searches are for cities where potential home buyers do not live. That is the highest percentage the website has seen since it started tracking that data several years back. Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tampa, Orlando, those are some of the top cities people are searching in. Meanwhile, I feel like I don't even have to tell you this, but search patterns show that the expensive coastal cities people are looking to leave include San Francisco, LA, and of course, New York. All right, we got to get out of here, but not before your moment of economic context. There is news out today that Birkenstock could soon go public. The private equity owner of the comfort sandal is set to launch an initial public offering as early as September. According to Bloomberg, it could be valued at as much as $10 billion. I should also say, most recently, the company saw a boost in sales thanks to the Barbie movie. Apparently, there was a scene of Margot Robbie donning a pair of, you guessed it, pink Birkenstocks. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. And I'm Rima Jerez. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM. Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.